Hello and welcome to News Roast. I'm Julian Rubinstein.
I'm Hayden Prowse.
And this is Three Courses of Conversation. Hey, what is this podcast about?
This is a sort of discursive metaphor for lunch.
Is it?
Or a luncheon metaphor for discussion.
Like a three-course meal of...
It's like a chat.
Like a starter, a lovely fat...
Yeah.
Beefy main.
That's right.
Or
yeah,
a vegan main if you're Ramesh, and then just so, a light trifling dessert.
A bit of a dessert, a nice sort of a amuse-bouche for dessert.
Yeah, this is the sort of podcast where if you are like just about to chat up a girl on the tube or someone you don't really know and you want to drop something that's kind of quite interesting, probably not too highbrow, but quite interesting, we are going to be your armory. We're just giving you the ammo to like...
What Julian isn't saying is this is basically mine and Julian's excuse to spend 2 hours with people that would never go for a drink with us.
That's true. It's like, it's just an opportunity, really, to get around a table with people who... We had John Lloyd last time. That was a bit mind-blowing.
We respect, fancy, admire, or want to be like.
And then we had Doc Brown, didn't we?
Had Doc Brown.
He blew my mind as well.
So this week
we are joined by none other than musical luminary
slash rebel without a cause
rebel with lots of causes. It's Lily Allen.
Oh my god!
So Lily, thank you so.
Sorry.
I don't think we've given this enough of a big up. Like I am absolutely over the flipping moon that you've decided to join us. I
couldn't see. You texted me at 3 a.m. saying can't sleep. ...
It's literally only because it's only because this happens to be on the way home from my therapist's office.
Right.
So that's all
right.
The only
safe. Oh, really?
I'm joking.
Jolene told me that you called him like 4 or 5 times a day. So please, can I be on the podcast?
Yeah, she was just desperate to be on the podcast.
She was desperate,
I didn't say that.
To sit in this green room.
But we did actually. Lily did actually. She was kind enough to. You know, we had a proper chat about it, and I in that chat we were able to say what I think me and Hayden both feel, which is that, you know, there are very few people who at this quite dark time are sort of standing up for basic compassion and the values that I see as intrinsic to why personally I'm proud to be like British. And you know, Lily, and you've taken a lot of flack for it, but you're one of those people doing it, so you know, we really respect that.
I mean, the thing is, I think quite, you know, I am quite politically active, and I do have this need to vocalise my political views. But I think, in a weird way, it's like, you know, I am pretty uneducated. You know, I left school when I was 15. I don't have any GCSEs. I don't have an A level. I'm interested in politics, and that's why. I feel like it's important for me to comment on these things, because there are a lot of other people out there that are uneducated and confused about the situation, and I kind of like to put my hands up and say I don't have the answers, you know. I don't have a degree in politics, but that doesn't mean that I can't be part of the conversation and can't ask questions either. You know, I think the whole system is sort of like geared towards scaring you out of wanting to get involved, because it's so sort of complicated and they use lots of long words. And
but I think that's part of the reason you've always been so popular in UK culture, even when you were, you know, just doing music and not being so politically sort of vociferous. You being so kind of, I just balls out about everything, you know, like not really caring too much, is something that I think everyone really respected. And now you're doing it in a sort of political sphere more and more, which is really brave, because, you know, in this world of Twitter wars, everyone just goes.
Well, I think there's not a lot of opportunity for people to make people look stupid on Twitter, you know, and that's kind of like the game for a lot of people. It's like someone says something, you dissect it, make yourself feel cleverer by responding, and it's like, haha, I won that argument.
I really killed it with that emoji.
Really,
God, that character and that
hashtag
really.
I really took them down. Truth tea, frog emoji, whatever. Everything that I do comes from a good place, you know. I am a narcissist in the sense that I love getting up on stage and I love it when people tell me how brilliant my songs are, you know. But that's kind of the extent of it. It doesn't really go past that. And everything that I say on Twitter or in these kind of forums, like, really genuinely does come from a good place. And, you know, I think as long as I keep that in the forefront of my mind, then all of the fallout I can kind of just dust it off.
Do you know what, though?
It's like, you know what? I know where that came from.
I think you're being a bit harsh on yourself, because I feel like I've had this conversation with a number of people recently. Like, any artist, any musician, anyone who's ever painted a beautiful piece of art has wanted people to look at it, have wanted something, you know, that, you know, Keats didn't write poems in order for no one to read them.
Mate,
you know,
Twitter, people didn't get on. Twitter is attention seeking.
Utterly.
What do you think it is?
But I think
it's
this
not
idea
a diary.
That it's like, oh, it's narcissism. It's just a bit like. It's a bit, I think it's a bit null and void. I want to take it right back to when you started out with your musical career, because in a way, you were sort of almost like the original MySpace star. I mean, people forget that now, but you, my understanding is, you know, you sort of had a deal, you were testing some stuff out, you were kind of like, had decided you were going to go your own way, and you started to release like Smile and London and a number of other tracks on your MySpace page, and that's how it blew up. Is that how it went?
I went to a party somewhere and I met Lady Sovereign, who I don't know if
you know. Lady Sovs.
And
up Lady Sovereign.
Yeah, S to the OV. So she came up to me and was like, oh, you should get into this thing called MySpace. I've just put my stuff up on MySpace. So I was like, okay.
What
so
is MySpace?
I literally got home and set it up. But by this point, I think I was it just in a deal. You know, I just signed my deal with Parlophone Records. But I was by no means the priority for them. You know, it was at the height of Coldplay and Kylie and the Gorillaz, and they signed me for £20,000. For 5 albums.
Wow.
And that, you know, nigh on 12 years ago. Yes.
Yeah, back in the day, that wasn't the jam.
And
was it?
And then I started. They had, you know, your MySpace player. So in those days, I'd go into the studio and I could put stuff that I'd done that day straight up.
That's,
you know,
amazing.
And I didn't have a fan base at the time, so there wasn't any risk, you know. If people, you know, record companies wouldn't let you do that now because there's a risk of things getting leaked and pirated or whatever. But in those days, I could do that and people responded really, really well. And then I started doing these mixtapes, which were, you know, amalgamation of my, you know, my songs and other stuff that I was inspired by. And then I did a first one and I used to spray paint the, you know, the covers. And they were like limited
them.
Editions. So stupid. It's
no,
so
not
funny.
At all. It was really
it's
ahead of
funny.
Its time.
I think of my mum's house because my mum was away when I did the mixtape, like spraying of the covers, and I took up her carpet and like did it on her oak floorboards, and the paint my colours are still there. But anyway,
those floorboards be worth something now.
Yeah, that's the original artwork.
But yeah, so then and it was, you know, really just sweet and organic. And actually, anything that I've ever done that has done well has always come from an organic place. You know, it's never been forced. And so people would respond to these mixtapes, and then it just kind of went from there. It was weird though, because the Observer Music Monthly, which no longer exists sadly, called up Parlophone and my record label and were like, we want to write an article about Lily Allen, and they were like, sorry, who? About like they didn't know who I was.
They
like,
no.
You know,
because
I was literally so small on their agenda. And Murray Chalmers, who's my head of press still, you know, walked down to the A&R department and was like, have we got someone called Lily Allen on our books? Because the Observer, I want to put her on the front cover of the magazine this weekend. And then that was it. But it was like a very transitional time in terms of the music industry. You know,
totally.
People were just starting to get their head around the internet. And, you know, all the chart systems kind of like changed accordingly. I still have no idea how it all works.
You stopped recording for a while and kind of started up your own label. Was that was that a constructive thing for you? Were you happy to do that for a while? Were you sick of it? Are you kind of ready to come back at all at this point?
I mean, I had basically, I did my first album and second album, and I think it was probably about 2005 or 2006 when I started to take a break. And I got, you know, I was pregnant. You know, pregnancy and small children don't go very well with touring the world. Yeah. So I decided to, you know, I set up a clothes shop actually with my sister, and I also set up a record label. And it was, I think, more because I'd been so isolated for so long, you know, literally flying around the world without, you know, friends or family and stuff, that I employed two people that came and work at the label that were people that I knew and was friendly with, and I was working with my sister on the shop thing. So it was like still getting up and going to work every day, but being surrounded by people that were like, like-minded and
friends, yeah.
And you know, creating jobs for people as well, which is a really important thing for me. So,
job creator. Yeah, yeah, it's what the Tories talk about a lot. You're a sort of
infrastructure. You know,
creating British infrastructure.
So, Lils, have you brought anything for our starter?
Yeah, well, I thought we could talk about clicktivism, clickbait.
Ah, clicktivism.
Clicktivism versus activism.
Yeah, nice.
What? Because everyone sort of sits on their computer signing petitions now, rather than actually taking it to the street and
which, by the way, I don't think is a bad thing. I think that it's great that people are online, and I think these petitions are great. And also, whenever I retweet one or you know, send people to that direction, I get a barrage of sort of alt-right, like, snowflake starting another petition, good luck with that, you know, like whatever. Anyway, it feels, you know, we are living in a different time, and I do worry slightly that you know, the activism that is happening online is not translating into the real world, and that's I find troubling.
I kind of feel like there's some value in scarcity, right? And there's so many fucking petitions now. It's like, why have I not saved the bees yet? I've signed about a million petitions to save the bees. Why haven't the bees been saved?
Why are the bees still dying?
Why are the bees still dying when I've signed like 50 petitions? Maybe there could be a
strange
few less.
One. It's sort of it's great that people feel active and that they're, you know, contributing, but it's not. It's also very convenient, isn't it, for politicians, because it's like, okay, yeah, cool, you have your arguments on Facebook. We'll just embezzle some money over here, or, you know, carpet bomb a Middle Eastern country.
Because it's actually, you wonder
why you argue about fake news. So I don't. Yeah. It's a difficult one. I was telling Jolyon yesterday that when I was a kid. I was born in 1985, and we were on holiday somewhere. I think we were like in the Caribbean. It was when the Berlin Wall was coming down, and my parents were both very staunch socialists, and they left us with the, you know, proprietors of the hotel and got on a plane to Germany to go and watch the wall come down. Wow. And you just sort of think, like, this day and age, you don't hear things like that.
We'd just have a Snapchat feed, wouldn't you? Someone would be fucking periscoping from it. People would be like, oh, I'm happy to just look at it on my phone.
Because and also, you know, I think online you can really, really sense the anger of people and the despair and the worry. But having an argument with, you know, Suzanne Moore on Facebook about it is not going to do anything, you know. And you sort of wonder, if you didn't have these chat rooms, you didn't have these petitions, would people be forced out on the streets, and would that implement real change? You know,
I mean, there is just to contextualise it.
I'm not encouraging looting and violence.
No,
but
there is that analogy about the Rebel Alliance and Luke Skywalker getting 2 million Ewoks to sign a petition and giving it to Lord Vader, begging him not to blow up their world. Like, how much use would that fucking be?
Maybe
ultimately,
if it was a Jedi petition where there was like, you know, You will not blow up this world.
Yeah, that would be good.
You will not blow up this world.
One person has signed this.
Yeah, two million people signed this. 2 million Ewoks.
But obviously, the sort of outtake from that is like, maybe you kind of got to be a little bit more sort of active. You know, it's easy to ignore a lot of signatures. Whereas
I'm still
not
buzzing the fact that Ewoks have got the internet. My mind is blown by just the fact that Ewoks have the internet.
I feel like
the Tories are just like, oh God, Quid, this is brilliant, the internet, isn't it? Like, remember last time around we did this? Yeah. We had like strikes, riots, everything was going mental. People were, you know, screaming at each other in the streets, and now they're all just doing it on Facebook, lol.
Just to contextualise this for people who don't know, What the actual situation is, as it stands currently, is that Parliament must, by law, debate any petition where over 100,000 signatures are given on the official UK Parliament website. Now, that's not change.org, that's not 38 Degrees, that's not any of the other, Some of Us, or any of the other petition sites. But unfortunately, as Hayden was saying, when 2 million people did sign a petition to debate whether President-elect Donald Trump was going to be allowed to speak in Parliament, they just threw it out. So it's quite clear that the system as it stands now really isn't fit for purpose.
Well, bringing the Dubs Amendment into it, it's like, they passed that.
Completely.
Well, that's so important.
That happened.
Right.
And like, they just petitions were signed, it was brought up in Parliament, they
so
passed
3,000
the bill,
refugee
and
children.
Then they just turned their backs.
Can you explain what the Dubs Amendment is, Lily, to people who maybe don't
know?
Well,
essentially, I think it was last June, Alf Dubs came up, presented this bill where we're meant to take 3,000 unaccompanied refugees,
right,
and look after them. And we said, you know, they had a debate about it in Parliament. I think at first it was, you know, sort of quashed, and then it was brought back up again, and eventually everybody got on board and the bill was passed.
It was even supported by the Daily Mail.
We were meant to be starting to, you know, accept these refugees, but then the Sun and the Mirror decided to print pictures of men in their, you know, of fighting age, as if, you know, they're the child refugees, which then...
And they rolled back.
Hey,
and
you know quite a lot about the Dobbs Amendment, don't you?
Well, it was helped refugees who I helped set up with Josie Norton.
Yeah, you know, why are you asking me?
People.
You know way more about this.
Well, I'm not
a guest, and no one's doing what I'm about to say. Yeah, so they're basically saying they're only going to take 350 refugees of an initially agreed 3,000. It was like a gentleman's agreement.
So that's what they're saying now, is it?
350 in total. And if you look at a film I just made for Help Refugees, which takes archive footage from before the Second World War and after the Second World War, which with the Kinder transport and the refugees we took from the Spanish Civil War, there's this footage of like 4,000 to 5,000 child refugees coming ashore at a time in Southampton or coming into London up the Thames on these boats. And like the news report is saying, you know, how incredibly inspiring it is that the British people are so welcoming to these poor kids that are fleeing war. And you flash forward 60 years and it's like, we are on such the wrong side of history now. You've got MPs questioning, saying we need to check these kids' dental records to make sure they're actually kids. It's just bizarre that people can't, you know, we tell ourselves...
I don't think it's bizarre at all. I think that what we're living in is a very, very bizarrely, openly polarised age where, you know, very sad really to bring it back to this, but I think it was last year, the death of Alan Kurdi, who was a small Syrian boy. There was a picture that went all around the world of a small drowned child lying on a beach, and totally understandably cutting through the brutality of all the wars and the kind of war fatigue that we all feel when we see these images of war, it really pulled people's hearts.
It really
seems to change people's hearts. And then unfortunately you know, the continuing bombardment by the Daily Mail, the Express, other right-leaning news organisations to simply terrify people. And I saw some very worrying information on Sunday on the Preston show. This will probably come out in a couple of weeks, so, you know, there'll probably be new information. But since Donald Trump's immigration ban, the Chatham House, who are very respected group who survey a number of issues, they surveyed in all European countries what the actual population thought about banning Muslim immigrants. And unfortunately, even in Britain, the vast majority of people are pro that ban.
It's insane, isn't it?
In the Netherlands, it's a bit more. In Spain, it's a bit more.
It's like, look at what happened to Lily Allen when she went out to Calais and totally, like, just moved to tears, essentially, by this poor child who was just without parents, jumping on trains, jumping on lorries, risking his life day in, day out. And you had this really human reaction to it. And the fucking response to that online was just vitriol. It was horrible.
Yeah, I mean, I feel slightly sort of anaesthetised to it now because any time I mention anything to do with refugees, children or not, the response, it's, you know, there is an army out there of right-wing...
Trolls.
Trolls, but could be soldiers. And I mean, like, who knows what they are or how incentivised they are, how far they're willing to go. But all I know is that if I was to put... you know, post a picture of a small child refugee on my Twitter now, the next 4 hours would be full. I mean, and when I say full, I mean hundreds and hundreds of St. George's Cross bearing football teams supporting. You know, I don't have got no problem with people that support football teams, but, you know, it is, there is a culture.
The cult of nationalism.
The culture is here.
Why is it?
But can we just go back? Can we go back though? Because this is really important about what happened with Lily.
Yeah.
Is I watched that video that you made, and what happened was that your words. The words that were focused on was the idea that you were apologising for Great Britain. And the Daily Mail focused in on one sentence of a 7-minute video produced by...
Funny enough, actually, it wasn't the Daily Mail, it was the BBC that did it first.
Well, so it was the BBC
who
took
that
story
first. Yeah, because the night before the interview came out, the BBC was seeding it, and they had taken that quote of, I apologise on behalf of Britain.
Because that is the age that we live in.
So the BBC are just as guilty.
If you looked at the video in your entirety, you're actually quite balanced about saying, look, this is a situation, I'm not going to pretend I understand
it. Also, fair dues apologising for your country. Sorry, like, I've been to bloody Greece and stood there when families come across borders with their kids from Iraq and Afghanistan fleeing the civil wars that we fucking started. Mm. Like, why should you not apologise for that?
Mm.
Of course you should.
Like, well, also, the thing, you know, I sort of remember the Gulf War a little bit from when I was a kid, and remember
91.
The Afghanistan war when, after 9/11, and you know, I was always under the illusion that we were going to, you know, save people. That's why we were there, you know. It was like, you know, to go and get the bad eggs, but also, you know, make sure that those places were okay for the women and the children and the innocent people. And it seems like we dropped the bombs, took the oil, and then you wear a hijab and you might be a terrorist in the future, so can you go, please?
But I think it's really important to contextualise the other half of that, which is whilst we're doing that away from home, people at home are, what they're really worried about, what their real true worry seems to me to be is, what money do I have in my bank account? You know, we read that over, you know, 200,000 people have zero money. They're in their overdraft in their bank account in this country. They have no job security. They don't know how they're going to pay for their children. And they feel this existential threat that someone is coming to take what little they have. And that is stoked and stoked and stoked. And it's so important because I think sometimes we focus on the left a bit too much on what's going on in foreign countries and not what the vulnerable mindset is are then hitting.
I completely agree with that, and I completely sympathise with people in that position. I just feel like they are being fed this line that immigrants are the reason that they're in that position.
Completely. I don't
and
think
that's
even
not true.
That is absolutely right. I mean, there are literally hundreds of Daily Express headlines.
There are people living
Daily
in squalor.
Mail
there are people being driven to the streets. And you know, there's some. Our health service is in an absolute state, but it's not because of immigrants.
Do you know how many? Guess what percentage of the refugee diaspora from Syria we've taken?
What is
of
it?
Of the 4.5 million.
What?
0.01.
Wow.
Americans taken 0.05.
Because it's amazing, because I was reading something. Gemma is a mate of mine who's just gone over to Lebanon, and you know, it's 1.8 million people that
living
they've
in
taken.
Lebanon from Syria.
Yeah, taken from the Syrian crisis.
Which is a country of, what, 2.5 million people or something?
Yeah. There would probably be people who listen to this podcast who go, right, well, Hayden and Jolly and your two guys who went to, you know, private school, lived in North London, liberals, Lily Allen, you know, liberal, pinko, actually literally wearing a pink jacket right now. And you guys don't, what you don't understand is that our culture is being eroded, that what
you know
was
what?
In
I
areas to- that...
I actually totally agree. Do you know what summarised this for me?
I don't know what our culture is.
What summarised this for me
the
other day?
Well, this is important. Let's let Lily say that. When you say that, like, what our culture is, like, when you say that, what does that mean when you say don't know what our culture is?
As a white person born in 1985 in England, I don't culture?
I don't know, it's the great in
it's
Great Britain, I guess.
That might be for like male
match
culture,
of the day,
but like,
match of the day,
cricket,
no, but it's not. I mean, pims. You know, those are interests of mine, but I definitely don't have a sense of.
Well, I think it's
our
probably
whole culture
different.
Is built on immigration, isn't it? So
but, well, it is
it's
here, but it's pastoral pictures. You know, so my parents, a while ago, they moved out to Kent, and I definitely became much more aware there that they're like a pastoral Britain, a Britain that because I grew up in inner city London, I didn't really connect with. Village pubs and greens, and the good things about this, like genuinely good, you know, community. People talking to their neighbours, connecting with them, village fates, village halls. It absolutely does. Okay. And I'm absolutely, I've been really surprised.
I live in Gloucestershire quite a lot of the time, and there is a real sense.
Has
of
it changed
community.
Your perspective living in Gloucestershire for a while?
What I actually found quite funny, because you know, I moved there just before I had my first daughter, and you know, I've grown up in like in showbiz London really all my life. And I, within like 6 months, I knew that I would feel safer leaving my children in the hands of these people that I'd only just met than I would leaving them with my friends that from London, like, wow. 16 years.
That's saying a lot, boy.
Yeah. Just because Gloucestershire, because of that sense of community.
Well, because it's about family, and it's about watching out for your next. And our neighbours down there, you know, were so sweet. You know, when we moved down there, lots of photographers would like sort of be like hiding in bushes and stuff, and people would come to the town and ask, "Oh, where's Lily Allen's house?" And everyone in the town was just like, "No, I don't know what you're talking about."
Like a murder.
And even like,
you're
you
like
know,
the godfather
if,
of the local
even
village.
If like, you know, DHL come to visit and you know to give you a package, you can't find my house because it's down some really long track, and like my neighbours would be like, "No, you have to show us photo ID. We have to call your
Amazing.
Office in order to check that you're the person you say you are." So yeah, that you know,
my peoples.
Yeah,
I can really relate to that. I was at Christmas a couple of years ago. My parents moved to Kent, and there was a huge storm, and loads of trees came down. They knocked down all the power lines. And we had no electricity on Christmas Day and the day after. And everyone came out of their houses. And there was a guy who lived two doors down who was a paraplegic. And the entire street suddenly started, like, buzzing, trying to help each other, bringing candles around and stuff like that. And I did think, being honest, that I can't imagine that happening in North London, where I was living in Kentish Town. I think people would have been worried. They would have almost barricaded themselves in the house.
Okay,
and I think,
so that's
you know,
nice.
It's an
that's
interesting
nice
thing.
Sort of like, you know, familial kind of like English culture. But is that under threat from immigration?
Well, I think the feeling the newspapers
I think we're our own threat because, well, I can only use this as an example because it's happened to me, but... somebody moved into the house over the road from me in London a couple of weeks ago, and they came over and were like, "Oh, hi, you know, Mr. and Mrs. So-so, we've got kids that are the same age and blah, blah, blah. Let's go to the pub." And it felt a bit weird. It was a bit
really?
Like,
so what
it's
you
like,
doing? Creep?
This is London. We don't.
Yeah, we do.
We don't talk
to our neighbours. What are you talking about?
It's like, you're not expecting me to like turn up with a pie or something. Yeah.
it's totally
it's
true.
It's not going to happen.
Is Gloucestershire Brexit land?
It is a little bit. Yeah.
So how do you get on with your neighbours? Do you have to like
just
not
talk
about?
I just don't really
talk about
that kind of thing.
Politics,
I know what I know what the viewpoint is. And also, it's like, you know, you sort of, I bring it up and I have my, you know, snowflake lefty view on it, and I can sort of feel people like retreating because they don't want to get into a conversation with it with me because they know what my viewpoint is.
Do you think a lot of them might have been Muslim band supporters?
No, I don't think they
not
are.
Not that bad.
I think it's really dangerous though, because I think it's so important at this point, at this juncture in history, to not like vilify these people and to like really try and empathise and sympathise with their viewpoint.
I was about to say that.
Look, I mean, I really think the most stupid thing about it all. Well, there are two things that I find really, really stupid. And actually, I was going to do a Brexit kind of theme programme with Vice, you know, quite recently. And we sat down to have a meeting about it. And they were like, "Right, we're going to divide this show up into four sections.
You're going to call it Hard Breakfast.
It's going to be, you know, immigration, the single market, you know, whatever else, you know, the two sections were." And I was just like, "Well, this is it." And actually, is that... we are about to, you know, do a television programme about this subject. Yeah. And in order to get our heads around it, we've had to divide it up into four sections.
Is that complicated?
The general public were not given that option.
Yeah.
It was like leave or stay. Yeah. And that, I kind of feel like, was the main problem with it. It's just like, you're right, as you said earlier on in the programme, if you have got nothing, which so many people in this country have got... are you going to tick stay the same?
Yeah.
Or change.
Nothing changes.
Yeah.
Or
totally. Let's mix it up.
Change.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And that was the dumbest thing about it, I think.
Like,
just the phrasing of the question itself.
It and also a government that had just formulated the kind of economic conditions that just encouraged like extreme amounts of division in terms of wealth. Then asking that question, having pushed people apart, putting people into abject poverty. And I mean, like, do you want to change this?
Yeah. Mm. David Cameron called this vote, thinking he could control the rampant underbelly of nationalism which rises. Because, you see, the thing is that patriotism and that thing about, you know, just is when I watch an England match at the World Cup, when I saw, you know, Gary Lineker get us into, you know, the World Cup semi-final with Germany when I was a kid, I was just, England, it's amazing. And there's a part of every young guy, I think, that has that still in them. And I think that it gets
interesting
activated.
That you related to football.
But the activation of that sort of very powerful force. And I think that Aaron Banks, who funded the Leave campaign, Paul Nuttall of UKIP, you know, Nigel Farage of UKIP, they understand this. They're political technicians. And they, I personally think, completely amorally just pushed. It's like when you've got a mosquito bite. If you keep pushing it and you don't put anything on to soothe it, it just will become a welt and it will take over your whole body. And I think, you know, they say a lot of stuff about the Leave campaign and stuff, but these are very clever people. And I think they understood
also,
that.
Also, but with the, you know, we as Brits, we are very, very stubborn people, and people do feel legitimised now. And even if they feel like they might have made the wrong decision, they're not going to go back.
No way. It would have to get really bad for them to admit.
It's like saying, you know.
Well, on Question Time the other day, Owen Smith, who, you know, is called for another referendum, you know, he got absolutely booed by an audience of people who, I read an article which said, we're in an economic area which is going to be devastated by a cut to European funding for their most basic local services. Mm. And people don't realise how bad
but it's when the rug gets pulled out.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things people comment on a lot on my social media is when, you know, if I talk about the NHS and stuff, and they're like, well, you know, you I'm sure you're private. It's like, yeah, I am private. Do you know how much it costs?
This is the thing. Because if you think
things are bad now, you wait till you have to pay for your own healthcare. It's not a fucking joke.
We have to take... Okay, fair enough. You're actually relieving a bit of burden on the NHS by going private.
In a weird way, that's... I mean, I don't feel like I have to justify it. Well, there's many reasons that I use private... You know, and I don't always use private healthcare. Yeah. Like, you know, I've had one of my babies in NHS hospital. There were problems with that, you know, where my privacy was concerned and stuff. And so that's why I decided to go private.
Yeah.
But, you know, I have a private GP. My kids go to a state school.
Yeah.
You know, with the job that I have and the touring and my scheduling, it's just like, I cannot wait 5 weeks to get a CAT scan, you know, in order to my insurance to be able to go on tour. So, I have to go private. But I do see those bills. They are very real. And they are terrifying. I mean, they're not terrifying to me because, I can afford them very, very luckily. But it's not looking good. The NHS is the second biggest employer in the world after the Chinese army.
Yeah, that is incredible, isn't it?
Mad ting.
Mad ting.
But, you know, yeah, the NHS were, like, actually very instrumental in, you know, the birth of one of my children. And I love the NHS and everything it stands for. I've seen its decline over the past 15 years, you know. I think when I had my first kid, the midwife came every day, you know, to check and do what it is that they're supposed to. But, you know, only 4 years later into a Tory government, I think we had one visit.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. Absolutely. It was pretty, pretty bad. And you know, I do go private. And as much as it is for my own convenience, it's also because I love the NHS and I know how strapped it is and how important it is for people. If I can ease that burden in some way, then I'm quite happy to do so.
I think Jeremy Hunt actually thinks we're stupid. Like, I think he thinks we're really stupid because what's happening
right now...
Well, usually
stupid people think that way.
Yeah, is that, you know, he's going on radio. I heard him on Radio 4 recently say, you know, the situation in hospitals is unacceptable, that the mid-staffs crisis has to be avoided again, but they will not increase any money into the NHS. It's almost like a sort of weird sort of delusional mindset that he thinks that we don't understand that if you don't put any more money into the system, and literally I'm just talking about paying for more nurses, paying for more shifts to be...
Yeah, but they just want to run it into the ground, don't they, so that they can privatise
it.
He actually did write a book talking about the defunding of the NHS, which, by the way, according to a Washington think tank, well-respected, the NHS is the best health service in the world. You know, and a friend of mine whose mum's got cancer told me recently.
It has been but I don't think it. I don't know if
no,
it is.
No, I still think it's. That's what's so incredible. Even now, you know, with what it's going through, it's still seen. And a lot of people see it as the crowning achievement
depends
of all
you go, the thing.
I think there are other places in Europe where health
gets sweeter.
The thing is, talking about an organisation that is the second biggest employer of anyone in the world is like trying to generalise about America. It's like a lot of things going on. Some hospitals are really in badly need of renovation. Some hospitals are excellent. It's like, you know, that's the reason you can generalise about the NHS and give one example and use that to kind of.
But I think that's true in some regard. But I think, personally, having literally had my life saved twice by the NHS, once when I had a peritonitis, once, you know, literally in 2016 where I had Quinsey and almost choked to death, the amount of time that the staff have, the consultants have to see people, the junior doctors, the hours that they're expected to work, it's unmanageable. But this very interesting point that a friend of mine...
It's horrendous. It's awful. I also nearly died on the NHS, and it was to do with funding, the reason that things got so bad.
Really?
And secondarily, to that, a couple of years or a year and a half ago, my daughter fell over outside our house and split her chin open on a railing. And I called an ambulance. They said it was going to take half an hour. And, you know, this is like a huge gash in a 2-year-old's neck, you know? And then eventually I hailed a cab, you know, and was holding her chin together with a piece of flannel and got to the hospital. And I said, you know, where's A&E for my daughter? And they said, oh, if you just take a ticket and take a seat.
Yeah, 4-hour wait.
It's like, my daughter has a hole in her neck. Can someone do something?
I was
really, you know, you can't hold it against the doctors and the nurses because it is not their fault.
Well, the junior doctors have actually come out saying, like, please, we are literally saying everything we can, and yet this government crushes them. I mean,
what's
that word austerity.
What's the ambulance? The BBC, is it BBC ambulance show where they're in the ambulance with the
paramedics?
The paramedics show where they're desperately trying to get to 5 people at once and they can't get to them. This old guy's at the bottom of a stairwell. He's been waiting for like 3-4 hours for them to arrive. It's fucked.
It's desperate.
And it's not just our health services, it's our police services. It's,
the prison services aren't coming in. Just to say, this is a really, really important point about the NHS, there's some stuff that gets completely lost in the, because stories don't want to be covered by the media sometimes. And this is one of them. This is, if you have doubts about the NHS, think about this, right? As Lily said, the NHS is the second biggest employer in the whole world. And that means that they can also negotiate quite seriously with big pharmaceutical companies. So a friend of mine's mum has cancer. And this cancer drug, even if you had the best private insurance in America, would not be available to you because it's too expensive. But the NHS can go to the pharmaceutical company and say, we're not paying that. And they lower the price because the bulk booking that they're making, the amount of drug that they're buying for all their patients, means that it makes sense for the private pharmaceutical company to lower the prices. So think about that next time that you slate the NHS, because even if we did go private, our waiting times might go down, but the price of the drugs that we would go up and they may not be available to us. Big up to my friends who gave me
NHS.
Actually, once I went on holiday with my dad when I was about 14, skiing, and I got in a quite a big accident. Somebody crashed into me at high speed, and I had to be airlifted off the side of a mountain.
Nils.
I woke up in a hospital. My dad was standing next to the bed, and he was like, Joanne? I was like, sorry? He's like, Joanne, everything's going to be okay. And then he like whispered in my ear, he was like, we haven't got any insurance.
Oh my God.
So Lily, what have you brought us for a metaphorical main today?
My metaphorical main course today is, what is Rupert Murdoch up to?
Oh, wow. Because you went to this summer party with my friend Nimrod.
That was amazing.
Which was absolutely,
I'll correct you there, Nimrod came with
hilarious.
Me. It was my invitation.
I assumed you'd have probably been invited, not Nimrod. But then...
this was incredible video content of the most incredible
citizen
journalist.
It really at the time.
Probably the most inspired tweet I've ever seen in my life was Jerry Hall taking Murdoch off back into the house, and you just tweeted, nappy change. He has this posture like he has just shat his pants. And Jerry is like sort of like wheeling him into the house.
So let's let Lily tell us
about the party. What was going on?
How did you end up at a party with Rupert Murdoch, Lily?
Well, contrary to popular belief, like, people probably associate me with like falling out of nightclubs and going to such showbiz parties, right? But realistically, in the last 5 years, I haven't really been doing that much.
All about
of it.
The nappies.
I have pulled a whitey at carnival, and I have also been hospitalised at Glastonbury. But that was two events in 2 years.
Just twice.
Which actually really were the only two like incidents. Both happened to end up on the front pages of the Sun.
Yeah,
let's not
use Glastonbury. low key event.
Most people can have an extra, you know, a pint too many and just go and vomit
basically,
out the back of the pub. But I.
You don't have any stamina anymore, basically.
It ends up on the front pages of the tabloids for me.
So, anyway.
Anyway. So yeah, this garden party. So there's a guy called Yevgeny Lebedev,
Evening
who
standard.
Is a, you know, media mogul type. You know, person, and you know he's quite sweet, and I've you know, I've met him several times, and he invites me to, you know, he has like in showbiz world, like, you know, big movers and shakers, they throw parties, they invite
the
famous people, they invite politicians, they invite royalty, you know, everyone gets together and they network and probably talk about where they're going to hide their money next year. Anyway, they I used to get invited to these parties.
Not anymore.
Me and Hayden are totally open to these invitations, Yevgeny. It's totally fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. So anyway, I've been to a couple of these parties before. Yevgeny invited me. He's got this flat in London, which he usually does them in at Christmas time. And the last time I went to one, there was like Boris Johnson, Ed Miliband, Nigel Farage was there, but this was about sort of 4 or 5 years ago. And you're Bob Geldof and, you know, whoever else. Naomi Campbell. I mean, literally, mad amount of famous people in one place. All eating caviar. Anyway, so Yevgeny's like throwing one in the summer, and it is the weekend after June the 24th, so the Brexit vote. And you know, as I said, haven't really been in the habit of like going to things recently because I'm just sort of having a bit of downtime. But because it was Brexit and because of the people that I'd seen at Yevgeny's party the time previously, I thought, right, I bet you this could be quite interesting.
Take advantage.
So I asked my friend Nimrod to come with me, who's, you know, provocative, political analyst, I guess, in
provocation
some ways, and and we actually turned up about half an hour early. And what was quite interesting was that there were four people there when we arrived. Rupert Murdoch, Yevgeny Lebedev, Nigel Farage and Sadiq Khan.
Just post-Brexit.
The week, like 3 days after Brexit happened.
Wow.
And Nigel Farage is wearing Union Jack loafers.
What a prick.
Man of the people.
And I mean, I don't know if it was like purposefully like meant to be like that, like sort of shock and awe in a way, you know, because it was, you know, I'm 31 years old. I was deeply affected by, you know, the referendum result, and to walk into this party and be confronted by basically three of the people that.
What were they doing? Were they sort of sacrificing a virgin or having canapes? Or?
Well, I mean, we laugh, but in all seriousness, what were they doing?
Yeah.
Because, like, it's not awesome. Very often that, like, Rupert Murdoch turns up first to a party.
Yeah.
Or any, you know, or any of those people. Like, Nigel Farage, surely he would want to make a grand entrance. So why are these four guys there together?
Do you think he's
half
the
an hour before everyone else is meant to arrive? Mm. That's a meeting.
So what,
I'm sorry, it was.
No, it is. Did you listen in at all? Did you catch any like snippets of conversation?
I was like, "What's going?" I said, "You know, what's going on here?" Oh, I was like, "Hello, right, boys." And
oh my God, it's Lily Allen. What's happening?
They're like, "Oh God, who invited her?" No, I don't. It was strange. Nigel Farage kind of came up and sort of wanted to make contact, and I was just like, "This isn't happening."
Sorry,
so I turned around, and and Sadiq Khan came over and, you know, wanted to have a chat, and I was talking to him about Jeremy Corbyn and a bunch of other things, and I said to him, you know, what are you doing here? And he said, well, you know, these are the people that make things happen in London.
Wow.
And I was just like, no, that's you.
That's amazing. You told the mayor of London.
Yeah.
What did he say?
he didn't really have anything to respond with to that. And I said, is this in your official diary, this you being here?
Yeah.
And he kind of fuzzed it, and he said he was on the way to see a Beyonce concert.
Oh my God. So, you just, I mean, sometimes I think this fact is so much stranger than fiction. I mean, imagining you walking into, you know, seeing Rupert Murdoch, I think, in the flesh would be quite scary anyway. But to see, you know, Rupert Murdoch, Nigel Farage, Sadiq Khan, and Lebedev in one room. And I think also, because if I remember rightly, Liam Fox turned up
with Sarah Sands, and I don't really understand Liam Fox.
Well, he probably thought he was going to be Tory leader at that point.
That's what it felt like, because it was, I think Cameron had probably stepped down the day
Cameron
before
had stepped down,
or something.
Yeah.
And Rupert Murdoch sitting next to Jerry Hall on one side, Liam Fox on the other side, Sarah Sands, who's now
Today programme.
Well, you all talking about what plan are you hatching, you know? And but it seems like Liam Fox is quite instrumental in being a sort of link between Murdoch, Gove.
He's a sort of fluffer.
Theresa May. I mean, I think he's the puppeteer, I think, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I was very shocked.
He's
when
the one
I heard...
that's like getting on private jets paid for by lobbyists to kind of go to DC.
He's big into transatlantic trade. He's a proper neoliberal capitalist. He doesn't, you know, he's really not about state whatsoever.
I found it very, very worrying when I heard that, you know, Rupert Murdoch had been in the room with Michael Gove and Donald Trump when they had the interview together. Mm. And I think in terms of what you're saying,
it didn't surprise me. Well, I did find it. I mean, what they're saying that News Corp is the, out of every single company in the UK, is the company that visits 10 Downing Street more than any other.
Yeah, right.
I mean,
but it's extraordinary, isn't it? Because we sort of live in this almost world where amnesia is necessary to survive, because people have obviously now for an awfully long time been talking about Rupert Murdoch and the undue influence that some people believe that he wields. And somehow... It just continues and continues and continues, and it's a very strange, you know, world where we live in, where, you know, that's kind of how the media landscape is. Whether it was, you know, I think he was exonerated, wasn't he, after the hacking, scandal. I think it really sort of, for me anyway, I think the public perception of Murdoch changed when that guy. Sort of tried to attack him in a courtroom. Do you remember
when
that?
Wendy Deng slapped him in the face.
Yeah, and it sort of looked suddenly like this quite old man who's quite vulnerable. Yeah, and I think that, you know, it's kind of... And then I think I even felt, you know, oh, look at this poor human being, you know.
Oh, no,
and
I never felt that.
Well, the thing is that I think the image that you watch on television is very powerful. I think it can have an effect
about,
on you.
Think about the fact that when Tony Blair came to power, he had to do a deal with the Sun. He had to do a deal with Murdoch, which is common knowledge. And
alleged.
I think it's
sort of widely talked about. That was the deal, was the Sun would support the Labour Party, New Labour at the time.
They shifted from Brown to him,
which is why
they
said it was the Sun what won it when Labour won the election. But then you flash forward and you have the Tory Party after their first election, when they're in coalition with the Liberal Democrats, and you have this huge hacking scandal where the government turns on News International, turns on Rupert Murdoch, and you've got someone halts the takeover. You've got someone very close to Cameron, who then has to leave and then goes to jail. What was his name?
Andy Coulson.
And then the Sun decides to take a position on Brexit, which effectively loses the Prime Minister who headed that sort of anti-Murdoch, anti-News International ship, loses his job, and you have someone else in power who is, you know, potentially very open to Rupert Murdoch's... You know.
And it even got crazier just after Brexit, if you remember, because suddenly Michael Gove's wife, her emails were
speaking
very openly about how, you know, certain newspaper proprietors would not support a certain leader. And, you know, the definition of an autocracy is where the public vote does not have anything to do with who leads a country. And what I find ironic in the extreme, especially when we talk about, you know, Nigel Farage and, you know, Rupert Murdoch and stuff. Nigel Farage, ex-public schoolboy guy who worked in the city. You know, Rupert Murdoch, an Australian Lord Rothermere, who inherited his tax status from his father, who is non-domiciled, which means that
the Barclay
you're not paying
brothers,
tax.
Who own the Telegraph.
Also,
the
I think Barclay quite a lot of that are
also offshore.
These are the people who are giving us our news. These are the people who are preying on the vulnerable people in Gloucestershire, in Kent, who don't have it, who are saying the immigrants are to blame.
It really scared me. And the next day, after I woke up after that thing, I was just like, fuck, that was my opportunity. I literally should have stood up on the table and gone, you fucking bastards, what the fuck have you done to my country? I hate you all. But I didn't. And neither did anyone else there, you know. And there were about 250 people there. And this is kind of what I was a bit struck by, and where I think there is, I don't want to come across as being some mad conspiracy theorist, but I do think that there is there's a game being played in terms of, you know, turning people into submissives, you know. And there were lots and lots of very, you know, Janet Street Porter was there, the pet shop boys were there, I was there, you know, Amol was there, like, you know, lots
of
people.
The kind of commentariat.
Yeah, and people that have got, a reputation for sort of speaking their mind, and yet you're in a room with Rupert Murdoch, you know, these two men who have committed a really, really heinous act, I think, you know, in terms of pushing the Brexit through. And yet you've got this room full of 250 so-called political commentators and not one of them says anything.
Yeah.
What do you think?
It was really surreal.
There's a weird complicity.
It's really surreal, and they're almost kind of like starstruck by it as well.
What do you think it is, Lily? Like, when you see it, what's
I think, like, well, because Sadiq was, you know, new on the scene in terms of, you know, just been made mayor. And I thought it was quite telling, the thing that he said when, he was like, these are the people that make things happen in London. Because I think that what you do is you put, people with real power, people like Sadiq, but aren't necessarily like au fait with how the system or that side of the system works yet, because it's sort of relatively new. And it's like, hey, look, if you spend enough money, put on some nice wine, some nice wine, decorate your tables nicely, and, you know, make it a pleasant experience for everyone, you can turn people that can be potential threats into
allies. And you tell yourself.
And it's like, it was almost like, hey, Sadiq, look, this is all you have to do. These guys, you can make them on your side. All it takes is a few canapés and a bottle of Chateau Neuf de Pape.
And do you think after a certain amount of time that gets kind of diluted and watered down a little bit until you're essentially just complicit in the whole?
Well, I think, like, you know, when you... That's the sort of danger with sort of aspiration and capitalism, isn't it? It's like you suddenly start winning, you make money, and then you're like, shit, I don't want to go back. So,
I think you're being quite forgiving, to Sadiq Khan in a way, because he was kind of Ed Miliband's main spin doctor. I think he's probably aware of what he's doing. But I mean, taking the contrarian point of view, you know, some people would probably say, look, it's a summer party, it's by a newspaper proprietor. Sure, you know, Rupert Murdoch happens to be one of the guests, but there's no grand conspiracy here. It is just people, seeming to be, in an event, happened to be at the same time, didn't know they would be there. You've been to quite a lot of these things, and you've also sort of obviously suffered a lot at the hands of, you know, papers that owned by Murdoch.
I have to say that these things that I go to, though, like those kind of events, I don't go to them for pleasure. I go to them because I am genuinely fascinated by how these people interact with each other.
And what's your impression of that? How do you see that?
I just find it amazing how you can watch two people argue on either side of the, you know, House of Commons, and then 6 hours later be at a party together drinking cocktails and eating caviar.
Yeah. So when we're talking about, like, what kind of plan, you know, Rupert Murdoch has, I mean, this is a conspiracy theorist conspiracy theory in a way, almost as old as time itself. Although, you know, as a subscriber to Private Eye, time and again, the stories that come out about News International are quite shocking. But what do you think? What's your take on it? Because obviously I personally haven't been the subject of, you know, it's been quite...
I think if you take me out of it, like, I don't... I'm a young, or I was a young woman.
Oh, you're still youngish, love.
A pop star, and so I know I'm pretty comfortable with that. You know, you're going to have your good days and your bad days where the media is concerned. That's how it works. I'm genuinely baffled by Rupert Murdoch. I don't understand what he wants.
Sure. He just wants global influence, doesn't he?
He's got global influence.
Of course, but once you're a billionaire and you have everything you could ever possibly want in the world, all you then want is power. Then it becomes about power, and that's why he's...
When you've got that power, why use it to divide people and destroy small countries?
But that's ever since the Roman Empire, that's been any empire's divide and conquer, isn't it? The more he can kind of be divisive and the more he can kind of split people apart for his own ends, that serves his purposes, no?
So what do you think he was like? I could go into politics, but actually PR is probably
much more effective. Buying politicians, yeah.
I have a theory that he's been just controlling the world to such an extent for such a long time.
Yeah.
He's in his mid to late 80s, probably about to croak it, and he can't bear the idea that somebody else might take over, you know, might start pulling the strings, and so he's like, I'm just going to blow it up.
Oh, just destroy it.
Yeah.
Right. Number one supervillain.
Yeah.
Is this your King Lear reference?
Kind of.
So you can't decide whether it's, what are all his sons called? Duncan and...
James.
And James. Like, he doesn't want to let James or Duncan take the business, so he's just like, destroy it all,
I think,
mate.
He definitely plays them all off against each other. I have a friend that is father to... Liz Murdoch's daughter, who's about 16 years old now, and she'd been grounded, but she had been allowed to go to one party during this grounding because it was Halloween, and so my friend of mine called me up, and this was like a couple of weeks after the whole refugee situation where I was being slagged off in the Sun and the Mail like hourly. So my friend called me up and he was like, look, Charlotte's been grounded, but I did promise her she'd go to this one party, but her mum's not around and I'm out of the country. Can you take her? And I was like, this is so surreal. Like,
so this is...
Rupert Murdoch's granddaughter.
Rupert Murdoch's
I've been
granddaughter.
Entrusted with.
Did you have to drive her to the party?
I took her there. I had to get her back home by a certain time.
Responsible adult, Lily Allen.
I was the designated driver, responsible adult, looking after the granddaughter of the person whose publication had been absolutely, like, annihilating me for the past 2 weeks. The mind boggles, doesn't it? It's
did like you think you, about sort of... kidnap for collateral or anything like that?
No, because I'm a nice
person. Next time
you've
got a story on me.
Any other normal person would be like, I will. Call her granddad and tell him to give me a fucking break.
Do you not think that maybe poor Murdy, poor Roops, deserves a bit of a break? You know, he got dumped by old Deng.
Yeah.
You know, like, he just give him a chance.
Give
maybe that's
Rupee
why he's
Murd
so angry
chance.
And going after people like you all the time because, you know, he's just a sad little old man.
No.
Maybe he just wants
to
smile.
Also, what's funny as well is the key, you know, people talking about this fake news stuff at the moment.
Yeah.
And
fake news.
Like, without wanting to, like, you know, get my tiny, tiny violin, which is somewhere in my bag here.
Have you got it, Lily? Good to see you got a tiny violin with you.
Fake news is not new to me.
Newsflash, fake news is not new. The Sun and the Daily Mail, which, extraordinarily, Wikipedia won't even link to anymore because they are, quote-unquote, generally misleading.
Right.
But they will connect with Fox News and they will connect to the Kremlin's Russia Today, but Wikipedia...
won't link as a reliable source
to the Daily Mail.
Because
it's
you've
amazing.
Been... Because, hold on a second, people accused you before of saying stuff about Beckham, which you hadn't. They made up articles about you,
Well, actually, it's definitely like big organisations like News Corp and Daily Mail have this tactic, which is they buy up much smaller publications in weird parts of the world. They get journalists to write articles that you think nobody would care about, and then they
publish, re-pick
up those articles
journalism.
And present it as...
Fake news.
Fact. So I've been party to this. You know, I've been like into several lawsuits with like sort of Estonian magazines that, funnily enough, have, you know, fronted by people that front English newspapers.
So the Estonian newspapers were fronted by who? Like,
I'm not going to give any particular examples, but, you know, there may well be some like football magazine in France that's also published by News Corp that will write some article about.
Yeah.
me slagging off Cheryl Cole because it relates to Ashley Cole, and then the Sun will pick it up and make it the head, the front cover. You know, I've been being written about by tabloids for the past 11 to 12 years.
Yeah,
I can hand on heart say that 90% of it has been factually incorrect.
Yeah,
And
wow,
and I would presume that that goes the same for articles written about everybody else,
like refugees.
So
or...
now that this inaccurate, you know, reporting is filtering into politics and to, you know, real people's lives, it's become an issue. But, you know, and I'm not saying it's not a sob story, but this has been happening for a long time and people haven't done anything.
I think
about
this is so important what you're saying about fake news, because it's like, I think the idea that we suddenly woke up one day and then suddenly the game had changed is just like, it's that it sort of makes us actually feel comfortable with the fact that it's been going on for so long and we haven't done anything about it.
The thing that you need to know about fake news is that once fake news is out there, the only way to get rid of it is to start a lawsuit, and it costs a lot of money to do so.
Yeah.
So if you're printing non-factual information and you've got an enormous bank account and lots of lawyers, you're pretty safe in writing what the hell you want, because if the person you're writing about is Kerry Katona and you happen to know that she hasn't got a penny to her name, what's she going to do?
Do you think... I think people always kind of knew that it was bullshit, didn't they? It's like the Sun and the Mirror and all the tabloids, they were just kind of like magical realism for the people. It was like, it was like, you know, reading... You picked it up because you wanted to hear something mad. Mm. You didn't really care whether it was real or not. And whether you became a victim of things like that because you were in the public eye. But the public kind of always knew. They took it with a pinch of salt every time they read
it. But I think the papers hated me because I was giving people mad.
Mad.
Well, like I was giving them like interesting stuff to read about, but they weren't making money from it, so they were like, shut her down.
Mark Twain once said that a lie can travel halfway around the world before the truth has even got its socks on. I wonder what he would have thought of Twitter.
I wonder what socks the truth wears.
Yeah.
Lily, thank you for those delicious
hash cakes
you brought for the first and the main. Can you tell us what you've brought for dessert? Is it hash cakes?
It's not hash cakes, no. Women's rights.
Ooh. Mm,
yummy.
So do you think women... I mean, because when we were talking about this kind of stuff, it's like, it's the equality thing you wanted to talk about, wasn't it? It was like, is it a myth? Or because of your... You thought your generation's the first that's had the myth of equality.
Yes, I think so. I mean, I was watching... I don't know if I was talking to you about it on the phone yesterday, but I was watching a... series on Netflix called The Good Girls Revolt, and
I've heard about this.
The pilot episode is about five women that work in a magazine sort of type scenario, like Newsweek kind of a thing, but in the 60s. And the way that the kind of business is sorted, I guess, is that half of the office are reporters and the other half are researchers. And, of course, all the reporters are men and the researchers are women. And they kind of also double up as, you know, assistants or secretaries or whatever. So, you know, the women are going out and they're getting all of the research. They're basically piecing all of these stories together and then handing them over to their reporters who literally write by Richard so-and-so. And they get, you know, paid three times the amount and the credit for doing all of the work. And I was watching this and I was thinking, wow, you know, this is like when my mum was born.
But it's, you know, as old as time.
And in my generation, you know, I was born in 1985, so I guess, you know, if you add 20 years onto that, that's what, 2005 is when you get into the workplace. And so things seem pretty equal at that point in time on the surface, because obviously we don't really know what's going on in terms of the pay gap, you know, behind the scenes. Like, you think that you're working in an equal environment, but there's every likelihood that the guy that's sitting next to you doing exactly the same job is earning twice as much money as you. So I think that this is why the Trump administration terrifies me so much.
Grown by the pussy.
And well, not necessarily the grabbing by the pussy, but just the sort of repeating on on human rights. It's like, you know, it started with the Muslim ban. It, you know, where's it going to go next? You know, he's talking about Chicago. He's talking about crime numbers. Mm. Who lives in Chicago? Lots of black people.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like, are black people next? Is it women after that? Is it, where is this going to stop?
Can I say something about the just an interesting thing about the pay gap quickly? This has been going on since the beginning of time. They anthropologists thought for years and years and years that early Homo sapiens had eaten a lot more meat than they actually had. Mm. And the reason they thought that is because every time a male group went out and caught anything like a mammoth, they would draw big murals about it in caves, and they'd boast about it, and they'd draw pictures on walls. Which made anthropologists think that early Homo sapiens had eaten a lot more meat than they actually had. But really what was happening was they were going out for months at a time, hardly ever catching anything, most of the time just like pissing around. Then coming home, the women had kind of done everything, made all the food, created, you know, the infrastructure and society, all that kind of stuff. And the men had just boasted about it by painting pictures on walls, which completely distorted the way people understood. And they looked at the bones around fires and realised they really caught fuck all most of the time.
Interesting tangent there from the pay gap between men and
women. Women haven't been sitting around doing nothing for the past, you know, 500 years. Yeah. Like, they've, you know, been getting up in the morning and going out and doing stuff with their day, just that haven't necessarily been getting paid for it, like their male counterparts. As I said, I was born in 1985. I kind of believed that we were on our way to some sort of equality. And by the way, I do not believe that the progress that's been made by women or the suffragette movement on either side of the Atlantic, or the civil rights movement, and the things that, you know, people of colour have had to go through, the journey that they've been on, we are no way nearly there yet. But Trump seriously jeopardises moving forward.
I think the whole new Labour thing, and sort of when we were growing up and stuff, I think we all thought that sort of gay rights, you know, civil rights, gender equality, that these were givens now, that the left had won the cultural war and stuff. Mm. And after we actually had that conversation the other night, I started having to do some research into this. And the actual gender pay gap in the UK is that women earn £300,000 less than men over their working life, which is quite staggering. According to Katie Allen, I'm not sure if she's a relation to you, who's the economics reporter at The Guardian, in March 2016, she reported that women are likely to earn £300,000 less than men over their working lives, according to new analysis that sparked fresh calls for more shared parental leave to close the UK's stubborn gender gap.
I'm an incredibly privileged person. I was 25 years old when I fell pregnant with my first child. But even in my profession, I realised what a disadvantage it put me at having children, you know. Not just like, you know, on a practical level, but on an emotional level as well. You know, society tells a woman as soon as they walk out of the door to go to work and they're leaving their kids behind that they're some kind of a failure.
Yeah.
You know, every article that's ever written about me in a tabloid newspaper will always be Lily Allen, mother of two, before it says singer.
Wow.
You know?
So it's the defining characteristic that society has decided to put on you as a sort of judgment about anything.
Yeah, and if you
next.
Read my timeline on my, you know, mentions on my Twitter, people are always like, why don't you spend less time on here and more time looking after your kids, you crap mum, you druggy bitch.
God.
Like, you know, it's like, wait a second, I'm the breadwinner, I've got a mortgage to pay, I leave my house, like, to go to work. Men have been doing this since the beginning of time, and have they ever felt an ounce of guilt? No. So why the fuck should I?
Well, there's a massive... I mean, it's the misogyny that is inherent in the culture currently. I mean, according to on International Women's Day, figures came out that showed that the gap is basically about 24% in the average full-time annual salary between men and women. That means more than four decades after the Equal Pay Act of 1970... The Four Court Society, who are a women's rights organisation, said that the analysis was the latest evidence of financial price paid by many women after having children, which is kind of exactly what you're saying. Why do you think it is so prevalent? Does it just give advantages to men? Is that why? And are they publishing the headlines? Or why do you think that is the narrative? When you're going out to earn your crust, to put, you know, food on the table for your kids, that it's a problem because you're a woman. Why does that exist in 2017, do you think?
Well, I think it's also to do with the fact that there is a severe lack of jobs in this country.
What I don't understand is how any woman in America voted for Donald Trump.
It's insane.
And
to
I think it's this weird thing where there's essentially kind of a form of apartheid that exists in large parts of the world where women are treated much like the black population were in South Africa in the 1980s. And it's inherently different, and it's key. The reason it's different is because the oppressed are in sort of often sexual or loving relationships with their oppressors. So it's messed up. You have this situation where, you know, if you believe in women's rights and you're a feminist, but the person you love most in the world is telling you, do you know what, I'm going to vote Donald Trump and it's going to be great for us and we're a family, we need to do it. I guess it's going to sway your political perspective.
Yeah, I mean,
bit,
I think what I was talking about with that programme that I was watching, The Good Girls Revolt, like the kind of premise of it is that these four women end up, you know, standing up for themselves and saying, you know, we deserve to be credited for our work, blah, blah, blah. But there is a lot of convincing that is going on within this office. So you've got these sort of three women who are trying to get all of the other women in the office on board. And they literally can't fathom a world where they can be the reporters, you know, they can take the credit and it can be their career and their profession. But I see it, you know, I see it in my work. Like, you would really, if you tomorrow decided that you wanted to write a music, you wanted to put together a pop album, but you only wanted female producers, you would really, really struggle.
Wow, really?
Yeah,
even
you
now?
You would really struggle to find female producers. And I don't think that's because females aren't producing. I think that women are so programmed to letting men take credit for their work that they're not taking the credit where it's due.
Who are the most famous female producers at the moment?
Well, they're usually sort of their own artists. So sort of Grimes does a lot of, you know, she famously doesn't let sort of men anywhere near any of her, from directing her videos to everything, like, because, you know, it's creativity. A lot of it is blagging, you know.
Totally.
And I think that a man, I mean, this is a sweeping generalization and only using sort of history as to sort of back me up, but I just think that men can more easily slip into, if someone says you're the producer, you'll be like, yeah, I'm the producer.
So
whereas if someone says to a woman, you produce that, they'd be like, really? I produced it? Do you know what I mean?
Like, it's... Have you seen that T-shirt that black women are wearing saying, Lord, give me the confidence of an average white male?
Yeah.
Oh, God. That is
because it's
shocking,
unjustified
it?
Confidence. It's true. I think there is a certain unjustified confidence that, you know, and it's a sort of... it's entitlement, isn't it?
And we slip into it. And also it's like it takes a certain type of woman or a certain type of confidence, or maybe we're just not quite there yet, where women are like, no, I did that.
Yeah.
I want to get paid for that and I want to be credited for that. You know, it's like, it's, I don't know what it, when I know what it is that you're scared of. We're scared of the, you know, the backlash. But
some of my best, some of my favourite placards from the recent Women's March as a guy was, men of quality do not fear equality. And I thought that was really good, as well as some of the kind of, you know, Carrie Fisher, RIP Carrie, who's just like, what a wonderful human being. You know, a woman's place is in the resistance.
I mean, you know, you've probably listened to the radio, or, you know,
had
a look at the charts once in a while in the past 10 years. And the music industry has been driven predominantly by women in the past
Beyonce,
10 years.
Adele. Look at what the Grammys recently.
You know, they're still, I mean, 3 years ago, I headlined Latitude Festival. Mm. The only reason I was able to do that is because Two Door Cinema Club cancelled. And I was the only female to have headlined a festival in the whole of Europe that summer.
Wow.
And it was because of a cancellation. The next summer, Florence headlined Glastonbury, only because the Foo Fighters cancelled.
Wow.
Yeah. Like, so...
And they kicked off about Florence headlining Glastonbury.
And we're selling more records than men.
Emily, but this is Emily Eavis booking this now. Why isn't she?
Emily is different. You know, she did put on Beyonce and she did put on Florence and she did. You know, she has done a lot, but for some reason, you know, festival promoters or the music industry, when they're putting on a festival, they want a macho male-led band because it makes their festival look like a stronger brand.
It's strange, isn't it? I mean, this is still, we're still in the throes of the beginning of...
And by the way, you know, when you're a festival promoter, you're probably like a third of your budget goes to the headliners, you know.
A whole third?
That's how big, that's how big the... Well, I'm kind of making that figure up. Okay. I'm sort of assuming that in terms of... however much money they've got to spend on artists, a big chunk of it will go on those headliners. So if you're a woman working in the music industry, you're not making any money from selling music or streams, because we don't. So your main source of income is live and branding. Now, if you don't really want to, like, get your boobs out and, you know, and do whatever it is, you know, advertise an underwear company, or you don't want to do a private gig for the Glock family in Austria, then that's your source of income. And if it's not afforded to you, you know, to be able to get those big slots just because you're a woman, it seems pretty unfair to
me. It's unbelievable, isn't it?
Not to mention the lack of creches backstage at festivals.
Yeah, I've never seen, in any festival I've been, like, I've never seen, like, child facilities. It's completely the opposite. It's incredibly loud and expected that everyone's drinking and smoking, and it's very difficult to bring young children along.
Not for my parents, they seem. They actually used to use me as a, as, like, advertising to sell... beer, like cider, out the back of a van with a sniff of Amel with every purchase.
Keith, what a man.
When I was like 6 weeks old, and people would come and be like, oh my God, look at your baby. And then they'd be like, yeah, 2 quid.
So listen, little pop quiz for you guys. Where in the world has the best gender equality in work? I'll give you 1 point for top 10, 2 points for top five, and if you get number one, I'll be super impressed.
Norway.
No, obviously not.
No, well, not Dubai. Norway. So that's, you're not going for a real one. Norway is number two in the gender equality.
It's be
so that's
an
3 points.
One, I can feel
3 points
Russia.
For Lily. Russia isn't even in the top 10, I'm afraid, Lily.
Okay.
Hayden.
So this is,
you've
Belgium.
Got two goes.
This is the best in the world.
Now, Lily, you've taken three goes. You've got to let Hayden have one go.
This
and
is the
Belgium.
Best.
No, I'm afraid not. That was 12.
Holland.
Belgium's 12.
Holland.
Not even in the top 10, mate.
What?
Not even in the top 10.
Denmark,
Hayden.
Letting me down, dear.
Denmark is number six. So that's 1 point. So that's 4 points. Actually, Lily has actually had five goes now. So you get two goes in a row. But
okay.
Lily's got 4 points. Hang on, Lily. Hayden, you've got two more goes.
This is Sweden.
Bang. Number three, Sweden. So Hayden's now on 3 points with one to go for Hayden. Then you get one more, Lily. Come on. Go on, Hayden. One more.
She said like four more than me.
Hayden, stop complaining. She's our guest. She can have as many as she wants.
Yeah, but she's just
Iceland.
Oh, she's got number one. It's Iceland. And congratulations, Lily. The crowd goes crazy. Oh, my goodness.
So Iceland is the most gender equal place in the entire world.
So yeah, Iceland actually had the first female... Well, you know, you say that, but actually Iceland, which is an incredible, if you, I'd love you to check out Michael Moore's films, Where to Invade Next. And he actually goes there. Now, Iceland was the first place to ever have a female president. Yeah. They've got the best gender equality laws in the world. And this is a bit shocking. The UK has made headway in some respects on gender equality at work, but according to separate research, we are rising up the league table. But where do you think Britain is in terms of gender equality in the workplace?
17.
They're actually 16th, so doing slightly better.
Pretty good, aren't I?
But isn't it quite worrying that in a ranking of 33 countries... So I'll just go through this so that you can understand this at home, because I find this quite shocking. We're 16th. Ahead of us are Portugal at 15th, France 14th, the US, Belgium, Poland, Switzerland, Luxembourg, Canada, Finland, Denmark, Slovakia, New Zealand, Sweden, Norway, and Iceland.
You know how in very, or sort of much more gender equal societies like ours, like we're all obsessed with things like 50 Shades of Grey, where it's like essentially sort of sadomasochism in sort of sexual context. Do you think in places like Saudi Arabia, where there's a lot of gender inequality, kinky talk is like, I'm going to let you drive a car and vote and do whatever you want. And it's just like massively, that's like dirty talk.
No, I don't, not really. Because I think if they said that, they'd have their tongues cut out. But Lily's not down with that. I'm thinking
about making you my third wife.
Your third wife. Yeah, it would be good though, because you could just reverse it, couldn't it? Because in Saudi, I mean, I actually just came back
from
a holiday in Malaysia, and I was actually quite shocked by how many men were walking around with their wives in having to be rather submissive in full sort of face veil and fully covered up, all with gold iPhones, walking around as well. But they also had their daughters with them, young daughters, all very unrestricted, jumping around, running around. And I just thought,
It's mad, that, isn't it? It's sort of like that your young girl, that they're sort of allowed to express themselves until they become a sort of sexual...
Exactly,
until
puberty.
And then it's like repression.
I actually got speaking to one of the husbands, and that is literally what he said to me, is that once they hit adolescence, and I said to him...
And it's taken away.
And you know, his wife said to me, his wife started kind of arguing in front of me, and, you know, there is a lot going on. And there is, it is also worth saying at this point, women's rights in Saudi Arabia is something that is very, very, you know, prominent on Twitter. A woman who put a music video together about talking about women's rights in Saudi Arabia was imprisoned almost immediately. And I think we take for granted the majority of women who live in this world right now are being repressed. Yeah. That is just a fact. You know, it's in the USA
and
the UK,
That we feel like we are making headway, or at least people of my generation feel like we're making headway. I'm seeing so many different, like, you know, groups of young women coming together in creative industries and creating these sort of, you know, nights where everyone comes and gives talks. And there seems to be almost like a sort of, like, young version of the WI happening, which is really, really exciting. But my real worry is, at the moment, is that how, you know, we went to bed on a Friday night a few weeks ago, and the next day, people from seven countries were banned from travelling to America. Things will be taken away from us before we've got a chance to fight.
Well, we have to resist. I mean,
I feel like we're going to wake up and it's going to be like, no, that's gone.
I do feel as well, like, if you look at quality of life, if you took those countries that you're talking about, right, and you compared the sort of the X and Y and the graph line of women's equality with the quality of life, I reckon they'd be pretty even. It generally, like, gender equality coincides with quality of life. Bring women's perspectives into politics, into business, having female perspectives wherever you are in your society generally just makes things a lot better, a lot more permissive, a lot more liberal, a lot more open. It's like, you know,
I think the main issue is in terms of our own society is that there are vast amounts of women that are perfectly capable to contribute to society.
Yeah.
They're not being allowed to because of childcare. To an employer, a woman with children is already a nuisance, right?
Right.
Kids are going to get sick. She's going to have to go home at some point to go and pick up her kids from nursery. You know, kid might get nits or, you know, whatever the fuck it is. Like, you know, it's difficult juggling being a professional and being a mother at the same time. If you split, not necessarily split, but, you know, took some of that money that we're pouring into the so-called infrastructure, into building daycare centres up and down the country, it affords women, you know, they can work, you know. It's very hard to, like, be able to get into working or to have a career if you've got children. And if the government can't help you with that, then you're stuck.
Yeah, there'll be those who obviously would say, listening to this, that, you know, obviously there are obviously women and female architects, female workers in some of these projects.
Listen, if you're an unemployed mother, right, and you're living off of child benefits, it's nigh on impossible to leave that way of life and get a job and get on the ladder, you know. Never mind thinking about owning a home, or, you know, that's so far down the line.
If you build you know, hundreds of thousands of daycare centres, suddenly you've liberated an entire section of the population to go back to work and help fuel the economy.
Yeah.
I think you should be leader. Lily Allen, like, next step after this new, you know, foray back into music, Lily Allen politician.
You reckon?
Yeah,
my boyfriend's surname is London, so if we got married, I'd be called Lily London.
Lily London, that is strong.
Why is it that people on who are sort of like remotely kind of cool and willing to kind of say things that might, you know, perhaps be slightly controversial, like you, which is part of the reason people are so into you in the UK, they go into like music or arts rather than politics. All the guys on the right, like the wankers like Nigel Farage, pardon me, who are prepared to say those things, they all go into politics. We need more people like you going into politics, not into the arts, because the arts just sucks them all up.
Yeah, I think things have changed so much. Simon Cowell is a lot to blame, and I mean, I really mean that. Like, it's not actually really a joke, you know, because before that whole sort of style or that kind of obsession with fame came into, you know, fruition, it you needed to, you know, play an instrument in order to write your own songs, or you know, or at least be in a band where other people played instruments. Mm. Generally, you needed to have something to stand for. You know, there's usually some kind of a political movement that went alongside any music. You know, you've got Summer of Love, you know, Rolling Stones, punk music, ska, whatever. Even the Streets. I mean, I feel like the Streets is kind of like the last example of sort
Plan
of, you
B,
know, political.
Ill
Manners. You know, social observation. I think the internet's a big part of it. I think, you know, when the internet essentially sort of demonetized music, not for record companies, just for artists, but it limited people in terms of how they were able to express themselves, because, you know, you can't really be singing about your political beliefs if you're, you know, doing gigs for arms dealers or oil barons.
So do you think your the new music that you're creating right now and that is going to be released sort of fairly imminently is going to be associated to a particular movement? And if so, what is that?
No, I don't think it is, actually. I think it's... Weirdly, this album is quite insular. It's not... there are a couple of songs on it that are, you know, commentary in terms of the state of the world, but mainly it's to do with, you know, me, my relationship, my children, breakdown of my marriage, substance abuse, etc. It is a really difficult balance because people do want catchy melodies, you know,
but you've paid a price for that.
When it was the Sex Pistols, you know, like, I am an only guy, so, you know, there's not really much melody, but that was the music that people were into then. Yeah. So if you release that now, people are probably not going to respond to it so well. So it's quite difficult to deliver a political message without sounding really priesty and earnest and have a catchy pop melody at the same time.
Yeah.
I have done it twice.
Well,
on this
here we
record,
go. So well, yes, I was going to talk about Fear, which was something I wanted to ask you about, because that was a very political chat. It was about consumerism and, you know, the rise of that and materialism. You know, I mean, from the outside sort of looking in, it feels like because you do take a stance, you get attacked by the press as a result of it. Do you think that's a fair comment?
Yeah, it's a fair observation. It isn't fair, but it's definitely accurate observation.
Tempted to stop taking a stance because it can all get a bit
not
much.
Really, no.
Just going to carry on, yeah, balls out, fighting.
Some of my views and some of the things that I talk about are political, but, you know, mostly where refugees are concerned, etc., it's not really a political conversation, it's a humanitarian conversation.
Totally.
And I really don't mind my career being negatively affected because I'm trying to, you know, get people to take notice of, you know...
Yeah.
Young children wandering around Europe aimlessly looking for somewhere to something.
Yeah.
Anything.
Do you find within the music industry that is unusual? Are other people sort of willing to take those stances, or are people so petrified about their careers that they won't come out?
I think it's two different things. I think that people are scared that they people. Well, I don't know, someone like Taylor Swift, for instance, you know, is an absolutely huge global megastar. If she suddenly came out and said that she was a Hillary supporter, she would lose half of her fan base.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. Yeah. That's a given. Like, a lot of her fan base are that blue collar, you know, that's who they are. Yeah. And I'm sure that filters through to here. I mean, I think what's happening at the moment, which is quite interesting, is that there's a real, you know, uptake in, you know, music that's made by children from less affluent areas than myself. You know, grime music is happening, and I think that's really fantastic. Still, I think a lot of the artists that make that kind of music, I've tried to approach and get them involved in political stuff. And quite right, you know, it's their own prerogative, they don't want to get involved, but that, yeah. You know, they've got the luxury, I've got the luxury of having been here for a long time. Those kids have only just got here, so it's a big risk for them.
Listen, Lily, well, you know, thank you so much for coming on our podcast. We're so happy. So tell us, when can we expect this album to drop? We're all going to be really excited about it. It's really going to be, you know, it's going to be massive.
I'm hoping around June.
Amazing. Summer album, has it got a sort of summer vibe? We're going to have like a new kind
there's
of smile to bop about
of,
in the streets.
Yeah, lilty bits in it, you know? Yeah.
Does that mean you're going to be at some festivals?
I don't know, actually. I think I might be a little bit too late for the festival boat. But what is quite good about not booking any festivals is that when there are cancellations, hopefully, if the album's doing well, then they'll call upon me to fill in.
Well, we're going to do some live stuff in the summer, so maybe we could get Lils to come up and like drop some heavy beats.
Yeah, if the price is right.
If the price, a couple of tennis, a couple of fivers. Thank you so much, Lily Allen, for coming on our podcast. We are massive fans.
Thanks, Lily. Yay.
Thanks for lunch. Producer Tyler.
Lunch?
Nice
I didn't get any lunch.
Well, this is our metaphorical feast, babes.
Oh, okay, that lunch. Oh.
You forgot about the metaphor.
Well, listen, on that bombshell, I will say thank you, Lily Allen. Thank you, Hayden Prowse. Thank you, Tyler, the producer. See you soon, guys.
Bye.
Bye.